is Justice Donald Steinmetz, and to his right, and on the far right, Justice Patrick Crooks. I introduce the bench not only for your sake and as a hearty welcome to Dave Prosser, but with the bench changing, this is a way of putting the bench into my head so I don't goof. With that, we'll call the first case, 96-0328, Kevin Peace versus Northwestern National Insurance Company. Mr. Pendergast, representing Northwest, you may proceed.
It is again a privilege to be before this court, and I hope what I have to say today does indeed please the court. My name again is John Pendergast. I'm with the Milwaukee law firm of Crivello, Carlson, Minkowski, and Steeves, and I represent Northwestern National Insurance Company, who is the petitioner in this matter. As a point, I guess, of bookkeeping, I did submit to the court this morning, pursuant to the court's notice, an article which was recently published, or at least published since my reply brief was filed, with the American Bar Association's Tort and Insurance Law Journal, which is an excellent recitation and summary of the law in this area, and my letter will serve as somewhat of an executive summary, and I intend to touch on the points raised there, but in your deliberation I would ask that you review that article as an additional authority, which does contain a very good review of the law and history, and I think it is relatively fair to both sides, although admittedly I think comes to a conclusion which favors my position. So administrative issue number one. Administrative issue number two is that in my reply brief, there is a typographical error at page 9, which is of some significance in that it omits the word not in a sentence, which of course would change the complete meaning of the sentence. And last time I was up here, Justice Bradley pointed out some shortcomings in one of the statements I made in my brief, and I want to make sure that I didn't repeat the same mistake. The very last line on page 9 has the words exclusion, was, to be so limited. Between the word was and to should be the word not. If those are clarifications, I'd like to discuss get to the issues in the case. Obviously, this is a case involving what has been called the absolute pollution exclusion. Of course, the words absolute pollution exclusion do not appear in the policy, but those terms have somehow become the shorthand to describe the exclusion that's at issue in this case. The exclusion itself actually is much broader than merely involving pollution, in that the exclusion itself defines pollution to include any solid, liquid, gaseous, or thermal irritant or contaminant, including smoke, vapor, soot, fumes, acids, alkalis, chemicals, and waste. So we're not just, although the term absolute pollution exclusion has been kind of tagged on this particular exclusion, The exclusion itself is much broader, and this court noted in the Donaldson case from last term that this particular exclusion was intended to be quite broad. This court in Donaldson, in reviewing this exclusion, set forth and adopted, I guess, the rationale of the Court of Appeals in adopting a two-step analysis to determine whether the pollution exclusion applies. The pollution exclusion, of course, applies to any claim for bodily injury or property damage, which we have here, but it must arise out of the discharge, dispersal, release, or escape of pollutants, as I've defined. And so the court in Donaldson adopted this two-step analysis. And the analysis is this. Are we dealing with a pollutant as defined under the policy? And if so, are we dealing with a discharge, dispersal, release, or escape of that pollutant? The court will recall in the Donaldson case involved a claim that exhaled carbon dioxide did not constitute a pollutant. The reasonable insured would not think that exhaled carbon dioxide was a pollutant, and so the court never reached the issue of addressing the language discharge, dispersal, release, or escape. So first I'd like to address the issue of whether, in this case, the lead paint flakes, chips, and dust contaminated with lead, which were alleged to have caused the plaintiff's lead poisoning, constitute a pollutant as defined by the policy. And, of course, distinct from the Donaldson case, lead is a chemical. It is a contaminant as alleged in the plaintiff's complaint. And I think more importantly in this case, most of the argument has been addressed to this second issue, the discharge, dispersal, release, and escape language. I don't think anyone, and I could be wrong, but I don't think we're going to hear a lot of argument today that lead, or lead in particular, lead paint chips, lead paint flakes, or dust contaminated with lead, which by law must be removed from a property, do not constitute waste, which is one of the definitions of pollutants under Northwestern National's policies and under this exclusion.
All right, counsel, and that's an issue I just want to ask a question on, because this, I think this case is, at least it has a unique factor in my opinion, and that is that this was a home that the owner had received notice, I think it was from the city of Milwaukee, and when we talk about a pollutant, and I assume that the reason he received notice is because lead was considered to be dangerous, and therefore he was to remove that. And I know you make issue and bring that up in your brief. Does that, the fact that he, and you seem to indicate that, received that notice, certainly put him on notice that something was amiss with the flaking or the chipping or whatever was happening, and eventually the ingesting of that into someone's body?
Correct. Go ahead.
No, my question is, doesn't that separate, or does it separate this, for how does this compare to the Donaldson situation?
Well, it addresses, in Donaldson, I think the court leaned heavily on the idea that a reasonable insured would not expect that exhaled carbon dioxide would be considered a pollutant or something bad. And I think the court really focused on that, and I think quite logically, I sometimes wondered how that case came to be heard here, because even being an advocate largely for insurance companies, I don't think I would have come up with the idea that exhaled carbon dioxide was a pollutant. even as defined under the policy. But this court looked at the reasonable expectations of the insured in that case, leaned heavily on that as opposed to really looking at the specific language of the policy. And so I put that, brought that information, put that information in my brief for the single reason of addressing the court's concern in Donaldson that the insured would not have a reasonable expectation that lead paint, flakes, dust were a pollutant. And in fact, the Milwaukee Code of Ordinances defines it as a hazardous substance and requires that such materials be removed as waste from the premises. So I included in the brief the fact, not only the fact that the Milwaukee Court of Ordinances required this material to be removed as waste, but in fact the insured in this case knew prior to Northwestern's policy even being issued that his property was contaminated with lead-containing materials.
But counsel, if we take that argument and run with it, then you could argue that this insurance policy meant different things to different insureds. I mean, if it had been issued the day after, before he got the notice, then you wouldn't have that argument. And isn't an insurance policy done on the basis of a reasonable person, not this particular insured?
I agree with you. And I'm not citing it to, I didn't point out that fact for the reason of saying, look at this insured had notice himself. I only pointed out as a fact that there is an ordinance in Milwaukee which prohibits allowing these types of substances on your property, and in fact, this particular person even knew of the existence of the substance. But I agree with you, I don't think the issue can't possibly logically turn on whether the insured had notice or not. I merely wanted to make the point that it was in fact the law in Milwaukee at the time that, and still is, by the way, that you cannot have these materials on your premises, and you will receive an order from the city of Milwaukee to remove this waste from your property if you allow it to exist.
And I also assume that there are maybe other communities that don't have such an ordinance about lead, and that your policy is probably, what, similar policies are statewide. So that I wonder if your argument can rest on that too. I agree that it makes a little weight, but.
Well, in isolation, I think if the Milwaukee's ordinance was the sole piece of legislation addressing the issue of whether lead paint constituted a contaminant or a pollutant, I think your argument would be stronger, or your question would weigh more heavily, at least on my conscience. But as I cited in our brief, it is universally acknowledged in every piece. I don't want to say every. I'm going to venture the assumption that in every significant piece of environmental legislation in the country, lead and lead-containing materials are considered pollutants. And this is true of Milwaukee's ordinance. It's true of CERCLA, it's true of RCRA, it's true of the Clean Water Act. So if in isolation, hypothetical community, Johnstown, happened to have an ordinance and saying that Twinkies were a pollutant, but the rest of the country didn't accept that as a fact, I agree. In isolation, I would agree with your point. The Milwaukee ordinance, although is a piece of a larger puzzle that tells us that almost universally lead and lead contaminated materials are considered pollutants by almost every governmental body, agency. I've cited a number of state statutes and state regulations referring to lead paint chips and flakes and dust as contaminants, as pollutants, as hazardous substances. So I don't know of anyone, in fact, even the case law cited by the plaintiff and Mr. Duchik, I don't think they have found one case, and I'm sure someone will get up and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think they found one case where a court anywhere has said that lead paint, chips, flakes, or dust, that this does not constitute a pollutant.
Mr. Pendergast, let me interrupt you for a minute. You talked a lot about Donaldson, and both sides talk a lot about Donaldson in the briefs. Donaldson cites with approval the pipe fitters case, and the pipe fitters case certainly is on point with what you're talking about right now. Why shouldn't that be decisive for us in this situation, the language from pipe fitters?
I almost said I'm glad you brought that up, and I didn't mean to be trite. The pipe fitters case involves a spill of PCB laden oil. That's what that case involves. And the court in pipe fitters found that spilling 80 gallons of PCB laden oil was pollution. Now, somewhere along the line, the court pointed out that some courts have found that substances such as lead, they cite McFadden, which is one of the principal cases relied on by my opposition, have adopted a different view of the pollution exclusion. If you read on in pipe fitters, however, as I note in my brief, the court says, other courts, however, have decided not to, and they cite the Minnesota, what I'll call a Minnesota Zamboni case, where the carbon monoxide from a Zamboni machine in an ice skating rink injured some people, and the Minnesota court said, well, we think that's covered by the pollution exclusion. So the quote in Donaldson from pipe fitters, if the quote would have continued on for another paragraph, the quote would have said, however, the court in pipe fitters didn't decide that issue because it was such an easy issue for them to decide with PCB-laden oil.
So however, the language talks about everyday or ordinary activities gone awry, such as paint flaking off a wall or chipping off a wall. Isn't that exactly what we're dealing with here?
Well, again,
I know in the article that you cited us to, you quoted, and in your letter, you quoted some language that says the authors of the article you've given us take a different approach.
Right.
But a lot of courts, perhaps the majority of courts, seem to have taken an approach similar to the language from pipe fitters. Is that not correct?
If you said the majority, I would say no. I think that the...
You think it's a close split?
I think it's a pretty close call, and I think that the difference is, as pointed out by the California court in the decision I cited, and I don't have the name off the top of my head, but it's cited in my brief, have looked to see whether the courts actually tried to interpret the ordinary, common and ordinary meaning of the terms in the exclusion, or whether they jumped quickly to what is the intent type of analysis. And it seems that the jurisdictions, such as ours, which look to the plain, ordinary meaning of the terms, have found in favor of applying the pollution exclusion. But I would like to address the issue of this everyday events gone slightly awry language from pipe fitters. Again, I don't think pipe fitters, the language that was cited in Donaldson, I understand why it was cited. It supported the decision, and for that reason I understand why it was included. But that language in Donaldson, in my mind, is dicta because it was unnecessary to the holding. That
how relevant is that, counsel? I mean, we're not bound by the Seventh Circuit anyway. The whole opinion, as far as this court goes, is not dicta. It's just for persuasive value. It's not at all binding on us. So what difference does it make if it's dicta or not?
What difference does it make?
Yeah.
Well, this court cited it. It's not authority. It's not binding on this court, and I would expect this court to reach its own independent conclusion. I'm more concerned about this court looking back on Donaldson and saying, well, we said it in Donaldson, so we better stick to that position. And that's why I'd like to address, if I could, this issue of this everyday events gone slightly awry standard.
Okay, why do you do that, counsel? It's easy, or relatively easy, to look at any of these cases and say the standard used in that case is not quite right for any reason. So while you're criticizing that, which you have every right to do, tell us what you think should be the appropriate standard for determining what is or is not a pollutant. Just so think about it as a positive as well as a negative.
All right. I'll address the positive first. I think the standard should be what the standard in this court has been for a long time, which is that we should look to the ordinary, common, ordinary meaning of the terms of the policy. The plaintiff and Mr. Duchek in this case have advocated a position of giving the terms in the policy meaning. They have claimed that these are terms of environmental art that they want to ascribe to the policy. The policy itself does not speak in terms of environmental claims. There is no indication that they are in fact terms of environmental art. They are words that should be given their plain and ordinary meaning. As pointed out in the Shelley article, these terms are release, dispersal, and escape actually were contained in the original 1970 exclusion, which in fact predated Superfund, predated RCRA, predated the Clean Water Act, and predated the precursor to the Clean Water Act. So to argue that these were terms actually excised from federal statutes is wrong. What I think the standard should be is the plain and ordinary meaning of the terms. I've given dictionary.
From the dictionary?
From a dictionary, and I think this court has held in the past that a dictionary is a fair place to look for a definition. And I've given dictionary definitions for those terms in my brief, and I think they're very broad. What this court has acknowledged in the past is that this exclusion was intended to be very broad, and to the extent that anyone would even look to the history of the drafting, the drafters of the exclusion intended it to be extremely broad, as this court noted in Donaldson. So there's the standard I think that should be applied and that I'm advocating. Environmental terms of art, special interpretation rules for this exclusion. Let's stick with the rules of interpretation we have. And I think under that situation, the case law supports my position. Plain, ordinary meaning of these terms, not using them as environmental terms of art, because that itself becomes a self-fulfilling argument. It's tautological. If they're environmental terms of art, then it only applies to environment.
Let me tell you what my problem with that is. I think that's what Justice Steinmetz wrote, in effect, in his dissent, and made that argument. And yet, you indicated that in that case, you would have held for Donaldson.
I only think that Donaldson was, in my mind, it was harder to argue that exhaled carbon dioxide was a pollutant as defined by the policy. I think it's a tougher case. I think this is an easier case. If I said I would have held for Donaldson, I would have had a harder time arguing that case than I do with this one, which I think is much simpler, in that lead, in my mind, is clearly a pollutant, and clearly, in this case, was released, where we have an allegation that we're only dealing with the chips, flakes, and dust. So we definitely have a release. Also on this environmental issue, the policy terms itself kind of belie that argument, because we're not just talking about landfills. It doesn't say we're not going to cover landfill problems. It says we're not going to cover solid, liquid, gaseous, thermal irritants or contaminants, including smoke, vapor, soot, fumes, acids, alkalis, chemicals, and waste. Some of these things, for instance, fumes, I don't think are typically a landfill type of an issue. It also contains language that says at premises you own or rent, as in this case. There aren't a lot of landfills at rental properties. So this idea that they want that we should just ascribe this landfill language onto this exclusion is completely belied by the terms of the exclusion itself. It was intended to be broad. It was intended to be very broad, and it includes fumes and other things which are not associated necessarily with landfills and at your premises. Unless these are only issued to landfills, I don't see how we get to the environmental, this must be environmental language.
Counsel, the question of the chief brings up, and referencing the dissent, brings up something that's of concern to me, and it's how you focus the inquiry. We can all agree, or maybe, that let's look at what the ordinary person would expect. That's the Hills versus General Casualty case. If you focus as the majority did in Donaldson, would the ordinary person expect human breathing to be a pollutant? The majority said no. The dissent focuses a little differently. The dissent says, would the ordinary person expect coverage? Arguably, you get a different result by using the same question, the same standard, the ordinary person's expectation, but focusing the question. With regard to Donaldson, for instance, you could say, would the ordinary person expect coverage in an insurance policy for human breathing? And the answer, arguably, could be no. Therefore, the exclusion applies. The ordinary person wouldn't anticipate that there would be coverage. It's reasonable that it's excluded. How can you reconcile that just that slight change in focus gives you a different result? Do you focus on the words of the policy, or do you focus on the broader coverage? Would you address that?
Sure. I think you have to focus on the words of the policy, because if you don't, you get this result. I think that my homeowner's policy covers all of my jewelry. I would think it would, but it doesn't. You have to have a rider for your personal jewelry. And I'm sure it's very clear in my policy that that's not covered. So what I think, my homeowner's insurance covers, cannot fly in the face of what the policy language itself says. So the simple answer to your question is, we have to look at the policy language, because I think every insured would say, I bought insurance. Why don't I have insurance? I would like to point out, as time is waning here, something the majority said in Donaldson, which is also significant to this issue. And the quote starts out, "It is also significant that, unlike the non-exhaustive list of pollutants contained in the pollution exclusion clause, exhaled carbon dioxide is universally present and generally harmless in all but the most unusual instances. In addition, the respiration process which produces exhaled carbon dioxide is a necessary and natural part of life. We are therefore hesitant to conclude that a reasonable insured would necessarily view exhaled carbon dioxide as in the same class as smoke, vapor, soot, fumes, acids, alkalis, chemicals, and waste." And I would submit, and lead contamination of their property.
Counsel, I see your time is up. Well, could you just spend about 30 seconds, because where my focus is on the second part, the discharge, and that's why I'm the most positive with your case, because lead was intended to be put into this paint. It certainly had to be accepted that paint was going to chip or peel away or something and leave fumes or whatever. And therefore, it seems to me that that this is simply not a discharge or a dispersal as intended by the terms of the policy. In terms of the policy, it seems to me, brought to, you know, this sudden gas goes flying or whatever goes flying, but this is just a natural event in some, and nobody knew 50 years ago that lead was going to cause this problem. Now it does.
Well, the answer to that question is this. No one expected that throwing an empty detergent box in a landfill in 1966 was going to be pollution, but it is under the federal Superfund laws. And so the fact that at one time something was a useful product does not make it today a useful product. There are many things that were useful products and continue to be useful products that are currently considered pollutants. Nail polish remover, if you throw that in a landfill, that's pollution. If the contents of that were dumped in a river, it would be pollution. Most of those chemicals are regulated by the federal government. So the fact that detergent or fingernail polish or a lot of things that have been used, even PCBs and some pesticides that have now been banned, as lead, which has now been banned, we would have no trouble finding that to be a pollutant if it was in a landfill. So the character of the product as being useful at one time does not change the fact that today it's contaminating the property where the plaintiff resides.
Well, counsel,
let me just push this just a bit. I'm filling up my hummingbird feeder last week up north, and I realized that on my shelf was a bottle of red dye that had ordinarily, years ago been used, and suddenly somebody found that this was very dangerous, this red dye. Now, are you saying that this, if I had, say, put that red dye into some cookies or something that I was making and got sick from it, that there would be no coverage under your policy because this was red dye that I had ingested? You say,
well,
what's your position on a case like that?
Well, I think that's a different case. This case is easier because of the fact that the lead paint, chips, dust, etc. are considered waste by just about anyone who would say whether you had to remove them or didn't have to remove them. I think there are some absurd situations where you could say there is an absurd situation where your argument doesn't work. But I don't think that argues, and when that absurd situation comes to the court, and perhaps the court thought that carbon dioxide case was that absurd situation, but when that absurd situation comes to the court, you can address that. And you can say, well, that case to me strikes me as absurd. But this case is not that case. And so I think you're right. With many things, it's a well-known rhetorical tool to use, that reductio ad absurdum argument. And so I think with any argument that's advanced, you can probably find an absurd result if you go far enough down the line. But I don't think that should lead this court to deviate in this case from the terms of this policy, which in this case I think are plain, to find that there's no coverage for this particular loss. Perhaps in that case you would look at it and you would say, I don't think that this policy unambiguously excludes that claim. But in this case, I think it's much more clear just looking at the plain language. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cohen, you have 15 minutes, and then Ms. Sumara has 15 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Culhane, and I'm from the Milwaukee law firm of Davis and Peelthau, and I represent the duplex owner in this case, Dujic Enterprises. If the peace complaint were to be sent today to the adjuster for Northwestern, and if that adjuster was asked to accept the defense of that case, and if that adjuster had just read the Donaldson case, I believe that that adjuster wouldn't even have a question, but that he would accept that tender of defense without even being on the reservation of rights. I don't say that just because Donaldson cites approvingly the Pipefitters case, which talks about lead paint chips and flakes, etc., and doesn't also talk about the McFadden case, the Massachusetts Supreme Court case with approval, but because Donaldson sets forth some limiting principles that are needed in the pollution exclusion because of the language used in that exclusion. The problem is, in the exclusion, is that it defines pollutant as meaning any irritant or contaminant. And when you have that definition or that meaning, you have to have some limiting principles associated with it. Otherwise, any product or any substance could be, you know, the triggering event for that exclusion, as used in the Pipefitters case, for example. If you slip on a spilled bottle of the contents of liquid Dranil, that could trigger the exclusion. Water, for example, if you are taking a shower and you are scalded by hot water in a hotel, that could trigger the exclusion because hot water is also an irritant. So I think it's ambiguous as one aspect of this case is applied to lead paint. Are we talking about any injury that's caused by an irritant? Even if the injury is not associated with the irritating nature of that product, or does the injury have to be irritating in nature, but caused by a substance which is ordinarily an irritant? I think it's confusing. And also, if I'm that claims adjuster, I won't know about the notice from the city of Milwaukee, by the way. That is a duty to defend issue, and under Wisconsin law, the duty to defend is a four corners analysis. You look at the complaint, you look at the policy. The City of Milwaukee ordinance will not be part of that analysis. That City of Milwaukee ordinance would be a determination made later as to whether or not the known loss exception to this policy should apply, or whether the expected or intended exclusion should apply. I don't believe it has any influence on the issues involved here. Also,
that issue was argued below, though.
I'm sorry?
The known exclusion, the known part of the policy was argued below.
Right.
It's not argued here.
It's not argued here. Also, I just want to make one more comment. There has been no discovery in this case. We don't even know if that notice was received by the insured in this case. There's been no discovery at all. But anyway, the first limiting principle I want to talk about in Donaldson, and incidentally, this is not even in Donaldson, we talk about the dictionary definition of terms, which are not defined in policies. The dictionary definition of pollutant is found in any dictionary as something impure, something not wanted. I don't see how the reasonable insured could think of paint or even lead paint as something impure or something unwanted. The paint was applied intentionally.
Do you think the reasonable insured would say that lead paint is wanted?
Lead paint, excuse me?
Is wanted.
I don't think the reasonable insured would say that lead paint is wanted. First of all,
Reasonable insured would say that lead paint is a pollutant.
I don't think the reasonable insured would say that lead paint is a pollutant, because first of all, most insureds won't know if it's lead paint or not. I mean, I don't think, even the Milwaukee ordinance doesn't require paint to be removed. It doesn't tell you, you have to determine whether it's lead or not. I think the Milwaukee ordinance says if the house was built before 75 and if it's chipping or peeling, you got to remove it.
Do you think the reasonable insured would consider lead paint as a pollutant?
I think it depends, Your Honor, on the circumstances.
I'm sorry?
It depends on the circumstances. If the lead paint is inside a residence, if when we talk about quantity, if we have, for example, in an otherwise well-maintained house, if there's a lead paint chip sitting on the floor, that person is not going to think of that lead paint chip as a pollutant, assuming he knows it contains lead. It all depends on the circumstances.
So there are no bright lines in definition?
I believe that there are no bright lights. There were no bright lines exactly with respect to lead paint inside a residence. I think that we get closer to the pollution exclusion when, for example, we're talking about, like in the Porbeau case, where there was an industrial removal of lead paint, and then it spilled onto an adjoining property, it then leached into the groundwater. That is a lead paint case that I think would trigger the exclusion.
Do you agree the proper standard, as espoused by opposing counsel, is that you look to the language, and that's where you start. You look to the language and the policy. Is that the standard that you're also espousing, or at least the method of analysis?
Yes, you look at the language and the policy, and when that language is not defined, you look at the ordinary dictionary definition of that language, but also you look at the language in context with the other language and the purpose of the policy, the purpose of the exclusion.
One of the briefs, the Insurance Environmental Litigation Association brief, makes the argument, as to others, but sets forth a separate argument. There is no support for engrafting a qualification that pollution must be environmental or industrial to fall within the absolute pollution exclusion. Essentially, the argument is that your position says is engrafting words into the policy. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think, Your Honor, if you look at the Beam versus Pouch case, where they talk somewhat about the
speak a little louder.
I'm sorry. If you look at the drafting history of the exclusion, which is found somewhat in Beam versus the Pouch case, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision, they talk about the pollution exclusion and how it used to be a sudden and accidental exclusion, and it used to be pertaining just to water, land, etc. Those exclusions, or those, that language was omitted eventually in the 1985 edition. But that has nothing to do with whether or not it should apply or not apply to environmental pollution. You still have to look at the expectation of the average insured. For example, the policy talks about it applies to premises you own or rent. That doesn't necessarily mean that it applies to non-environmental pollution, because you can still have environmental pollution at premises you own or rent.
Well, it doesn't mean that. You go into the history of the policy that I don't think their ordinary insured might know that. So we're staying with the language. From what words in the policy do you have a foundation to argue that it is only industrial or environmental pollution? What word, if you point the words in the policy, would you make
the first word would be the pollutant. Pollutant would be the first word. And the other words, which are to me personally not as graphic as the word pollutant, would be the discharge escape language, which goes along with that. I agree that those words in the dictionary definition do not have an environmental connotation. But if you use them in context with the word pollutant, then they do. And if you look at the rest of the policy, and I think they are talking about waste, for example. People don't use the word waste when they talk about lead paint, for example. I mean, waste is an environmental term of art. The non-exhaustive examples of pollutant, talk about fumes and alkalis and things like that, those seem to be generally byproducts of products or unwanted byproducts of valuable products. Lead paint is not one of them.
Well, but the lead is an unwanted byproduct when it flakes off.
I think there's a difference, Your Honor, between, for example, lead paint being a hazard or substance and being a pollutant under the policy.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you. There are a lot of dangerous things in a home. Ammonia, Clorox, Drano, etc. Justice Babbage's red dye. They can all cause great harm. So are they pollutants? What about the Drano in my house, which then somebody picks up and burns themselves with or takes a swallow of?
Yeah, I do not believe that that would be a triggering event because, first of all, it's inside the home. People would not think of Drano as a pollutant.
Would people think, if I may, Chief, would people think of, what was it, Ace Baking, a fabric softener?
Right.
As a pollutant?
Well,
that case, if I recall, didn't that fulfill the definition of pollutant?
In that case, Your Honor, the linalool, which was the ingredient in the fabric softener, I think which made the fabric softener smell good when it's inside your dryer, that got onto the ambient air and fouled some ice cream cones and made them smell bad and made the ice cream cones unusable. But I have a problem with that, too.
You're advancing a little bit because if you want it to be a pollutant, then you take the technical chemical that's in the fabric softener. But if you don't want it to be a pollutant, then you say, well, that's just fabric softener. I mean, you can't have it both ways.
I just think that any product potentially can be an irritant. My yellow light is on, and I'm just wondering
that
if I can
spend... That means you have about 5 minutes.
Okay. Just spend a couple of seconds talking about the discharge, escape, etc. portion of the policy. I think it's important to realize that...
Mr. Colleen, before you do that, you started out telling us that there should be limiting principles in regard to the pollution exclusion. Can you summarize what those limiting principles are?
Well, the first limiting principle is the definition of pollutant found in the dictionary. The second limiting principle is found in Donaldson, which talks about the exclusion has to be circumvented by reasonableness. The third one would be the quotation found in Heidfitters, which was approved in Donaldson, and that is that we now talk about pollution in terms of everyday activities gone slightly but not surprisingly awry. The comment I wanted to make about that is that I think it's more of an everyday activity where paint would peel off a wall where we do have a buildup of carbon dioxide in the air. So I would respectfully disagree with my counsel here. Those are the limiting principles I think found in Donaldson. With respect to the discharge section, I think it's important not to lose focus of the fact that the pollution exclusion says that the bodily injury, we don't cover bodily injuries which arise out of the discharge, etc., of a pollutant. Most people get lead poisoning from inhaling, ingesting, or absorbing lead paint. Those words are not used in the pollution exclusion. So I think what that means is, as a practical matter, is that the discharge, etc., must occur before the inhalation, absorption. It must be an independent event. That's what I think is important about the discharge section. And also I think it's important that there's a difference between the movement of a potential pollutant, which I believe lead paint is, and the discharge of it. Because even when lead paint comes off a wall and falls on the floor in the form of a paint flake, that lead paint flake is still not any more dangerous than it was before because it's still in its container, i.e. the paint. It hasn't fouled anything. And children can get just as injured by gnawing the paint off the windowsill as they can by, you know, picking up the lead paint chip and eating it. So, that's all I have.
I don't understand your argument, Counsel. If 80 gallons of oil or gasoline are spilled and contaminate the groundwater, I'm not injured until I actually drink it.
Right, and but
how is this different?
The water, the oil has escaped from the 55 gallon drum and was discharged into the ground, where it went into the groundwater. Paint, however, the lead is still sitting in the paint in its container. I think a reasonable interpretation of the exclusion is that it doesn't pertain to lead paint just on that basis. Because the lead still is sitting in its container, and it's not fouled anything. It hasn't fouled the groundwater. It's still sitting on the floor.
Do we know in this case how the person became injured by lead paint? Did they ingest it, or did they breathe it, or what did they do?
I don't know, Your Honor. I have never tried one of these cases. I'm just coverage counsel. I can just speculate that what happens is, over a period of years, lead paint sitting on windowsills and near doors is... When the opening and closing of the window pieces of dust then fall on the windowsill, and then the child, while watching for mommy or daddy to come home, gets it on their fingers and stick their fingers in their mouth. I think probably that's how it occurs, at least in my
speculation. Does the complaint in this case say that that's how it occurred?
No.
No.
It just talks about lead paint chips, flakes, and dust. But I also believe, Your Honor, finally, that even though this case doesn't talk about paint chips, it doesn't talk about intact, accessible painted surfaces. That was also in the Sukup case, and I believe that should be taken into consideration as well, as one of the sources of lead poisoning. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Sumara?
Good morning. Please, the court. My name is Michelle Sumara. I'm from the Milwaukee law firm of Perry Lerner, Quindell and Sachs.
We're going to have a little trouble hearing you. Yeah. Would you like to adjust the lectern, or is that comfortable for you?
It's fine, thank you.
All right.
I'll try to project more.
All right.
We represent the plaintiff, appellate, Kevin Pease. I'd like to address this environmental limitation. This pollution exclusion, also called the polluters exclusion, only applies to environmental type and industrial pollution. That's a clear doctrinal distinction and a limiting principle, which is consistent with the terms of the exclusion itself, consistent with the way the terms of the exclusion are used in the policy as a whole, consistent with Beam and Donaldson and Just, and consistent also with case law from the highest courts from all other jurisdictions which have addressed childhood lead poisoning. It's also consistent with the drafting history and the intent of the exclusion. Now, the terms of the exclusion, in ordinary usage, the operative terms connote environmental or industrial pollution. We know that because of the context in which they're used. The balance of the exclusion, outside of the definition and the discharge provisions, which really we're looking at in microcosm, the balance of the exclusion connotes an industrial or environmental context. It expressly refers to the handling, storage, containment, processing, disposal, or treatment of pollutants in the form of waste. Now, the policy terms. Outside the exclusion itself, Wisconsin law instructs us to look to the policy as a whole to see how and where these same terms are used. The policy gives context to the exclusion, and the environmental context, again, is inescapable. The term pollutant is used numerous times throughout the policy, each time expressly referring to or implying environmental waste and environmental pollutant cleanup. An identical definition of pollutant is also repeated numerous times within the policy in the context of environmental pollution.
Give us an example.
In the additional property coverage section, debris removal provisions, that's at Appendix 111.112 of my brief. This additional coverage doesn't apply to extract pollutants from land or water or remove, restore, or replace polluted land or water. This is a debris removal provision, truly environmental pollution, because it concerns extraction, or removal of pollutants from the environment, from the land or water. Another example at appendix to page 12, same contract section, regarding pollutant cleanup and removal, expressly regarding cleanup of pollutants discharged, released, or dispersed.
Are you referring to? What
same
page?
Contract no. Section, appendix page 112. Expressly referring to the cleanup of pollutants discharged, released, or dispersed on land or water. Next page, page 113, same contract section again regarding limits of insurance covering pollutant cleanup. Page 118, same contract section, definitions section. Again, the environmental context is inescapable, and in this provision, Northwestern repeats the identical definition of pollutants from the exclusion. Page 124.
I don't understand your argument there. I'm looking at page 118. So what if they repeat pollutants? Well, how does that tie into your argument that in contextually this obviously refers to environmental damage?
Because the context is waste, is debris removal and waste cleanup, and the governing definition is identical to that in the pollution exclusion.
I'm not following that either. I'm looking at page 118 of the appendix under definitions section H. Now, I don't see the words that you're referring to, so maybe that's why I'm not understanding the argument. Looking at pollutants, number one, under H.
The definition section applies to the provisions that I've been referring to previously, the debris removal provisions, which provide the inescapable environmental context.
Is fabric softener a pollutant?
Pardon?
Is fabric softener a pollutant?
It depends on the context. I don't think it is unambiguously a pollutant.
I'll make one more crack, Ms. Samara. You say, you're giving me a conclusion, you're not giving me a reason, or at least with respect to page 118. I'll listen carefully again to our argument. I may have missed it, but it sounds to me like you're speaking in conclusory terms and not in rationale terms.
Well, I've concluded from the use of the operative terms and the definition section from the exclusion, when it's repeated verbatim, identically, in the policy as a whole, where the environmental context...
And what is the environmental context?
Here it's debris removal from land and water.
And where do you see the word...
And we find that... Sorry. We find that back at page 112. And this definition section applies to give content to the earlier provisions where the term pollutant is used.
Well, on page 112, does it refer to debris removal?
I'm sorry, sir?
Where on page 112 does the policy refer to debris removal?
Well, actually, it's on page 118, continued on 112. Sorry to misdirect you there.
Well, on 112, there's a pollutant cleanup and removal expenses.
Yes.
But it doesn't say degree. I mean, that begs the question of what constitutes a pollutant, right?
Well, I understand your argument. Your argument here is if you look at other aspects of this policy, it's obviously referring to industrial wastes and environmental waste. So you're saying that because the back end of the policy refers to industrial waste, then, and it's using the same definition as you did in the other aspect of the policy, then you're arguing that the whole thing has only one meaning, and it means industrial waste. Is that your argument?
Yes, thank you. And that...
I don't know if it's persuasive, but I think that's what you're trying to tell us.
And that it is ambiguous when, in the context of childhood lead poisoning, we take an exclusion and a policy which uses... which has a clearly inescapable environmental context, and try to graft that into a onto the situation we have here, where a child in his residence ingested lead paint.
You just used the word ingested. Is that the basis of your complaint? Child actually put it in his mouth and swallowed it?
Yes, perhaps sucking his thumb, picking up a toy from the floor. However, as a practical matter, as Mr. Colhane noted, because the overarching question is childhood lead poisoning, I do believe that your decision must encompass the Vance situation where there was intact lead paint.
You're not relying on the intact versus not intact distinction of things.
No, I think that's... I think there is no distinction. The question is...
And your complaint is a very short form complaint. Just says ingested. It doesn't say how, when, where, and why.
Correct. Yes. Ingested lead, paint, flakes, and dust. Now, I also believe that limiting this application of this pollution to the environmental context, as I said before, is consistent with what we've learned from the Beam case, from Donaldson, and from Just. And in fact, I think this distinction, the environmental-only distinction, flows directly from those cases. In Beam, as you remember, the Court of Appeals found that application of the exclusion must take into account the context of the language and the history and purpose of the exclusion. The Court of Appeals clearly ruled that the nature and purpose of the exclusion limits its effects to claims of environmental damage.
Has this child been diagnosed medically as suffering from lead poisoning?
Yes.
Counsel, could I ask you, is the pollution clause going to be interpreted exactly the same way 20 years ago, if 20 years from now?
With regard to lead paint,
well,
to childhood lead poisoning?
With regard to what a pollutant is.
Well, I think what a pollutant is depends on the substance that you're dealing with and the reasonable expectation of the insured. That really is the question here, whether it's reasonable to expect that the substance at issue falls within the language of the exclusion, not just the definition section, but the dispersal section and the arising out of language, which Mr. Colhane pointed out is very significant.
I think what Justice Prosser is getting at is that the definition of pollutants change over the years as we find out more scientifically information depending upon certainly lead is something that within the common knowledge, I think of almost everyone, that lead is something that has been, there's been substantial indications that it is a pollutant. Now, the issue is whether in paint it's a pollutant, or how it gets out of that, or how it's dispersed or flakes off or whatever. But I think that that question goes to things that were not pollutants, as was pointed out by other members of the court. So is it clear or not clear? I guess you're saying, well, it's ambiguous because in order to recover, you would need that it was not clear that the pollution exclusion would apply to this type of liquid or paint or whatever we're talking about.
Yes, I think it's ambiguous.
Yes.
A lead paint chip is potentially a pollutant. Is lead paint adhered to the wall, lead paint adhered to the windowsill, which is not in any deteriorating condition? Is that also a pollutant solely because lead is contained within the paint? I think that's a hard question to answer, and I think in this context it's not.
Counselor, you emphasize context. Is it reasonable, would a reasonable landlord of a residential building include lead paint chips in the definition of pollution?
I think not. And I think that is the heart of this case. What would a reasonable insured expect? When a person thinks of pollution, you think of an oil spill, smokestack emissions.
Well, what do you think a landlord's exposure, or what do you think a landlord would think his or her exposure is with regard to pollutions? Or what kind of pollutant can a landlord anticipate emanating from the apartments in the complex?
Well, Your Honor, that's an interesting question, and I think I'm not sure that this policy was drafted with great precision. In fact, there's an exclusion for damages caused by volcanic eruption. Well, we don't expect volcanic eruption in Milwaukee.
So this policy really affords no protection to landlords because there's no pollution that would attach to being a landlord of a residential building.
If the landlord had oil heat in the building and oil and a tank in the ground outside the building contained the oil supplying the heating system, the tank ruptured and fouled the ground, the soil and the groundwater, that's clear pollution there. And this landlord would the exclusion would apply to that case of the residential landlord.
Well, Ms. Samara, you made a contextual argument, and I understood the argument, and the Chief Justice paraphrased it accurately as I understood it. But I look at other sections of the policy, and it seems to me that it's clear that the insurance company intended that this apply to other than environmental damages to land or water. For instance, I look at page 142. Or the general exclusion, where it says bodily injury, it doesn't cover bodily injury or property damages, and subsay says, at or from premises you own, rent, or occupy. How do you answer that argument?
Well, I don't think the premises language confuses the issue, frankly. I think the premises language is necessary to expand to the oil drum in the front yard situation, because without the premises language we're left with at or any site or location used by or for you or others for the handling, storage, disposal, processing, or treatment of waste. The balance of the exclusion refers to waste.